From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. We're getting more reaction and details about the death of Iran's top military commander in a U.S. airstrike at a Baghdad airport. Qassem Soleimani's assassination marks a major escalation in the tensions that have soared in the Middle East since an Iranian-backed militia killed an American contractor in Iraq last week. The State Department is urging U.S. citizens to leave Iraq immediately as Iran's president vows to take revenge for what he called a heinous crime. Joining us now for more is NPR national security correspondent David Welna. And David, Iranian TV, state TV, is reporting that 10 people were killed in that U.S. airstrike, and five of them were members of the Revolutionary Guard. What more do we know about how this attack was carried out and the Trump administration's reasoning?
Well, a U.S. official tells us the attack was carried out by a remotely piloted American military drone known as the MQ Reaper. It's a big aircraft with a 66-foot wingspan, and it can carry up to four laser-guided, heat-seeking Hellfire missiles that are designed specifically to hit moving targets with high precision. We're told the drone fired several missiles at the car carrying Qassem Soleimani, the commander of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps' Quds Force, which carries out operations outside Iran. He was blamed by the U.S. for the deaths of hundreds of U.S. forces in Iraq, but both Presidents Bush and Obama resisted taking him out in the way that President Trump has. They did not want to get into a Persian Gulf war with Iran, which is a far stronger adversary than Iraq ever was.
Mm-hmm. You talk about the previous administrations. There also was a statement by the Pentagon which accused Soleimani of actively developing plans to attack American diplomats and service members in Iraq. But Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said the killing was in response to imminent threat to American lives. The administration carried out this airstrike without consulting Congress, which everyone's talking about today. How has their justification for that been received?
Well, predictably, the response is splitting along party lines. Congressional Republicans are praising it as necessary and long overdue, and Democrats are making clear that while Soleimani was a bad actor and enemy of the U.S., carrying out what they're calling his assassination was also ill-considered, reckless, and could lead to precisely the kind of endless war that Trump vowed he'd never start. And part of this criticism, I think, comes from the fact that Democratic congressional leaders only learned about the airstrike after it was carried out. They're demanding that they be briefed on what the legal basis was for this and what the strategy is going forward, with Iran promising harsh retaliation and 4,000 more U.S. troops now being sent to the region.
Tell us a little bit more about Soleimani and his legacy. He was an architect of Iran's intelligence and military operations. Who was he, and what does his death mean for Iran?
Well, Qassem Soleimani was arguably the second most powerful figure in Iran after Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. And he was widely admired and seen as a potential future leader of Iran. And streets there are full of demonstrators today venting their anger over his death. And his funeral there is certain to bring out even bigger shows of fury.
Today's attack also killed paramilitary leader Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. Give us some context who he was and how significant his death is as well.
Right. And his funeral in Iraq is certain to bring out a lot of angry demonstrators, too. He was Iran's point man in Baghdad, and he was a close friend of General Soleimani. He was the deputy chief of the Personal Mobilization Units, a paramilitary force whose supporters attacked the American embassy in Baghdad this week. He was also a founder of the Hezbollah brigades in Iraq, and he is a huge foe, or was a huge foe, of the United States.
With the 30 seconds I have with you, you mentioned those troop movements. Do we have any other information on the larger strategy moving forward, what the U.S. is preparing for?
We don't really, except that we know that the 82nd Airborne Division, made up of paratroopers, a whole brigade is moving into the region. That's close to 4,000 troops, and they are there to respond to any action that may be taken. I think that we are seeing what really are preparations for war in the region, exactly the kind of war that President Trump vowed he would never get the U.S. involved in again.
Yeah, and we'll be watching more of this as the days and the hours go forward. That's NPR national security correspondent David Welna. David, thank you.
You're quite welcome, Tanya.
Another big story that we're watching, of course, is in Australia, where one of the largest evacuations in the country's history is now underway, as dangerous fire conditions are expected to get even worse this weekend. The Australian Defence Force is rescuing hundreds of people in coastal areas by sea, and on land, roads are backed up as others try to flee. At least 19 people have been killed since the fire season started early in September. Luke Henriquez Gomez is following this for The Guardian in Melbourne. We spoke yesterday, and I asked him about the scale of that evacuation effort.
It's incredibly complex. So in the 1970s, Australia suffered a massive cyclone called Cyclone Tracy. There were about 60,000 people evacuated or flown out of Darwin as a result of that. This is expected to rival that in terms of an evacuation.
And for those people who decide to stay put, what kind of dangers are they facing?
The past few weeks are anything to go by, their lives are likely to be at risk in some isolated communities. The state governments of New South Wales and Victoria have declared states of emergencies, which allows them to forcibly evacuate people from the area. Usually in these bushfire seasons, people have the decision to stay in their community and try and protect their homes. But in many cases now, they won't be given that opportunity, essentially because the government acknowledges that they won't be able to save those people if the fire front tears through those towns.
The flames are the immediate danger, but what about the smoke and the air quality across the entire country?
That's, I think, one of the most striking things for us in Australia at the moment. We're quite used to bushfires. It's a part of life for many people living in more regional communities and rural communities. But the smoke has, for people in Sydney and also in the capital, Canberra, become a real problem. Over the past week, Canberra has at least twice been the city with the worst air quality in the world, according to the Air Quality Index, which is a fairly surprising or shocking thing for a modern city with almost no industry at all. It's basically a city built on the bureaucracy. And so we also, this week, we've also heard news that one woman reportedly died stepping off a plane in Canberra. She was an elderly woman, but her relatives have said that they believe the smoke was a cause or a factor in her death, which was down to a sort of respiratory problems that she had after stepping off the plane.
Wow. You know, we spoke yesterday on this show about Prime Minister Scott Morrison getting ridiculed and mocked as he was meeting with Australians there near the scene of these fires for not doing enough in response. Does it appear to you today that the government is starting to get the message that more should be done if the people are to be kept safe and happy?
I think that's a difficult question to answer because the government, and particularly the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, have held a fairly consistent line. And so whether or not the government does change course, I guess I'm talking about perhaps both a change or a bolstering of the climate change policies, but also more money and resources for the fire services which are fighting these fires, that remains to be seen.
Luke, there's no question this is a human disaster, but we're also seeing these pictures and these videos of the animals, the wildlife, people giving water to injured and thirsty koalas, you know, kangaroos running through flames. What can you tell us about what impact this fire might have on the wildlife in the area?
Well, essentially, it is incredibly shocking impact. And in one coastal town in Victoria, they have been receiving koalas that are injured and trying to treat those koalas at the same time that town is in its own humanitarian crisis. That town is essentially completely isolated. There's no way to get in or out except by the sea.
What part of this story is keeping you up at night as you watch it all unfold?
It's a really good question, Peter. I guess it does come down to the danger that people in these isolated communities are in, and the fact that ultimately when the fire comes to them, that they have nothing that they can do except wait either in their homes or outside their homes, protecting their homes. Or in the case of some images that we saw around New Year's Eve, people were flocking to the beach because there was nowhere else to go. They were basically expected to hunker down on the sand or get into boats and perhaps get into the water as the flames drew closer and closer. That's fairly terrifying, and that is unprecedented in Australia. We've had some really tragic bushfires. You know, one in 2009 claimed the lives, about 180 lives. But we haven't had the fires in so many places converging on towns that are isolated and then blocked off for, in what we are told in some of these towns, will be 3-4 weeks without being able to get in or out. So I guess the isolation that the people in those towns are facing is really quite frightening and puts the whole thing into perspective.
Indeed, yeah. Luke Henriquez Gomez is a reporter for The Guardian based in Melbourne. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Peter.
Again, the forecast this weekend calls for extremely hot and windy conditions in eastern Australia, so we will hope for the best.
Okay, you've probably heard the phrase new year, new you. Well, what about a new you who resolves to watch more TV? If that's your bag, there's plenty of new shows to choose from. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans is here to tell us about a few of them. Hi, Eric. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Let's talk a little bit about the two upcoming shows that have caught your attention. The first is on the streaming service Apple TV Plus. It's called Little America, and it's an anthology show about the immigrant experience. What do you like about this one?
Well, this, you know, it's interesting. There was a moment last summer where Apple invited me to their TV headquarters in Los Angeles, and I saw pilot episodes for three shows that they were going to be doing, and this one was the one that moved me the most. Mm. They basically take true stories of immigrants, and they dramatize them. And the first episode that I saw, the pilot episode, was about this young boy whose parents get caught up in some sort of problem with their papers, and they have to leave the country for years. And he seems to be about 11 or 12 years old, and he has to run this motel that the family ran as a unit when the parents were in America. Hmm. And he comes across this idea that if he wins the National Spelling Bee, he will get to meet the first lady, who then was Laura Bush, and he might be able to plead his case in front of her to try and get her to help his parents. And so we have a scene where he's talking to a teacher. A teacher's talking to him and initially trying to tell him that he might want to enter the spelling bee because he's so good at spelling. And initially, he's a little resistant because of the responsibilities he has at home. Let's check out that scene.
You know, Kabir, every year you win the school spelling bee. Have you thought about competing at the state competition at Salt Lake? And then you could go to nationals. I mean, you know, the finalists meet the first lady. Wouldn't that be something?
I run an economy value in off Route 22. We're the third-ranked motel in Green River, according to TripAdvisor, and I'd like to keep it that way. I don't have time for spelling bees.
Eventually, he changes his mind and he enters the spelling bee. But I don't want to say what happens beyond that because that would be a huge spoiler.
Okay, that sounds like one that we want to check out for sure. The other show you're into is called HBO's The Outsider. It's based on a Stephen King novel and centers around the investigation of the murder of an 11-year-old boy. And Jason Bateman plays the primary suspect. Let's listen for a moment in the show when he's arrested while coaching a Little League game.
What's going on, Don?
Terrence Maitland, I'm arresting you for the murder of Frankie Peterson.
For the what?
Hold out your wrist, please.
What are you talking about? Hey, what are you doing?
You have the right to remain silent.
Don, what are you doing?
Do you understand what I'm saying to you?
Yeah.
Let's go.
Eric, tell us more about this one. Do you think it's an effective mystery?
Well, this is about, on its surface, it seems like it's about the gruesome murder of an 11-year-old boy and a popular Little League coach who gets arrested for the crime. But as the police start to look into it, they start to realize that even though there's tons of convincing evidence, including video evidence, that this Little League coach abducted this boy and killed him, there's also a ton of evidence that he was at a conference 60 miles away when the murder happened, and he couldn't possibly have done it. Mm. And so you get the sense that there's sort of a supernatural force at work.
Oh.
It's an effective mystery and horror, and a really interesting way to sort of take a murder mystery and add horror elements in the way that only Stephen King really can.
Okay, so with the little bit of time I have with you, you mentioned, of course, Jason Bateman is in this particular series, but he also directed it as well. And he also has this other show where he stars and directs, Netflix's Ozark, which comes out with its third season this year. Looks like Bateman may be having a moment right now.
Well, he's also an executive producer on both of these shows, and I think he's trying to develop a career for himself as someone behind the camera, someone who shapes the overall scope of the story that's being told in a TV series, not just as the star of a show. And Ozark, I've seen the first six episodes of the third season, the new season that won't debut for a while on Netflix. They've done a really good job on this. Also in 2020, we're going to see many more streaming services come. We've got about three different ones, HBO Max, Peacock from NBC, and Quibi, this service that is going to offer a bite-sized video to be seen on mobile phones. All of that is coming in April and May. And so we've got a lot of interesting stuff coming on TV in 2020.
Almost too much. This is why these segments help, because it helps us figure out what we should pay attention to. So thank you so much. This is NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Thank you so much.
That's why they pay me. Thanks a lot.
This Sunday, millions of folks will also be tuning in to the 77th Golden Globe Awards, and British comedian Ricky Gervais will be hosting the show for the fifth time. But that's not the only reason folks have been talking about him lately. For more on Gervais and the contenders for the top Golden Globe Awards this year, we're joined by Hollywood Reporter's senior film editor, Pia Sinaroy.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Okay, you just got back from London, where
I
know you had a chance to sit down with Ricky Gervais. First, let's talk about a tweet he fired off a few weeks ago that some people read as transphobic. It's always a tweet, isn't it?
It's always a tweet. The full story behind it is actually quite complicated and tied to a British legal case around transgender rights. But Ricky Gervais's tweet specifically was responding to a parody account, and not many people realize that. So it was a kind of strange joke that then, you know, kind of took a life of its own.
And this is not
him.
The first time that he's kind of been up against maybe remarks that folks have thought
Correct.
Of as transphobic.
Yes, I think a few years ago when he hosted the Golden Globes, he made a joke in 2016, I should say, he made a joke about Caitlyn Jenner that many deemed transphobic at the time. And I will say, even watching his live stand-up comedy special in 2018's Humanity, which is on Netflix, he elaborates on that joke and takes it further. So certainly there are comments he's made and jokes he's made that have been considered that.
You asked him several times about that.
I did.
If he is transphobic, and what was his response to that?
He says he isn't. He says the jokes, he says he is not transphobic, but that the jokes that he tells are part of what he believes is freedom of speech. It's being able to, he's known to take on taboo subjects, and so it's part of that rhetoric of his that he takes that on and addresses it and puts it on the stage with him. But you know, I think that's his think that's his way of looking at it.
It's interesting also because in your interview with him, he mentioned his process for writing his material for the Globes and how he stops to think, have I got anything? Meaning that has he said anything that could get him in trouble, so to speak? He referenced comedian Kevin Hart and the backlash Kevin received when that 10-year-old tweet surfaced that some considered homophobic. What more did he say about that?
I think he was basically saying that he feels that his jokes have to be bulletproof. In this day and age, and not just in this day and age, but he feels that even just going forward that they have to be bulletproof in 10 years' time. So for him, he's saying that he's going to be targeting individuals less this year and focusing more on kind of the state of the industry. So he wants to take shots at, you know, cinema and the networks and the industry overall. And as he's mentioned, the hand that feeds him.
Yeah. It's really interesting because comedians as a whole, they often take non-controversial topics.
Yeah.
But in this cancel culture that we're in, it takes on a new meaning, especially when they're in front of large audiences, like being a host of the Golden Globes. Well, yeah. While I have you in the short time that I have, the big player this year is Netflix. They're up for so many awards this year in the Golden Globes.
They are.
Best Picture, Best Comedy, several categories. What's your take on that?
I think Netflix is going all out this year to try and score those top prizes. And when I say top prizes, I mean the best drama and the best comedy prizes at the Globes. I mean the Best Picture Oscar race. So they're very much, you know, pulling out all the stops. They have four films contending in Best Drama and Best Comedy at the Globes this weekend. I think they really want those top accolades. It means a lot for them to get that because it's prestige. Yeah. And they are new players and they need that.
In the comedy realm, Dolomite is one that is a top contender. There are also a couple of others. Jojo Rabbit, Knives Out, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Rocket Man. Which one do you think is going to take the prize?
You know, I think the coolest thing about all of those is that they're all so very different to each other. I just think purely because of how well Once Upon a Time in Hollywood did, and, you know, how star-studded it is. And we know that the Golden Globes voters love stars. And, you know, it was one of Tarantino's, like, highest performing films. I could see that edging out the competition, but I will say all those other movies have a very good shot as well. Knives Out, people are loving that movie.
Yeah, and as you said, this is the precursor to the Oscars. Those who win Golden Globes are often thought to be those to watch for the Oscars.
Yes, even though the voting membership of the Oscars and the Golden Globes don't overlap, this is a huge stage for contenders to go up there, for winners to give that big, passionate speech and to impress people. It's a big showcase for them to gain steam, hopefully, in the rest of award season.
That's Hollywood reporter, senior film editor Pia Sinha-Roy. Her latest article on Ricky Gervais is in the latest issue of Hollywood Reporter. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And the Golden Globe Awards, along with all of those pre-fashion shows, airs this coming Sunday.
Iran is vowing revenge today after U.S. forces assassinated top military commander Qassem Soleimani at the airport in Baghdad early this morning. The BBC's Lina Sinjab is in Beirut. And Lina, Soleimani was arguably the second most powerful man in Iran. How is the news of this drone strike and his death being received across the region today?
Well, this is like seen as a big blow to Iran. It's the airstrike that killed Qasem Soleimani have crossed the big red line for the country. This is the most powerful man after the supreme leader Khamenei, and he's not only seen as a general in charge of the Al-Quds Brigade, but also seen as the architect of their foreign policy, of their military involvement in the region, and he's the one who shaped many cities in the region, especially in Iraq, in Syria, in Lebanon, and also recently in Yemen.
Thousands of mourners have taken to the streets across Iran today, so he was revered there. How did Iraqis feel about him?
Well, there's definitely a split in the views in the Iraqi, but the vast majorities, especially among youth, celebrated this news. We've seen protests taken to the streets in thousands in Iraqi cities and mainly in Baghdad as well. And they were angry about Iranian influence in Iraq that they blame for destabilizing the country and for the violence in the country. For the first time, we've seen the youth even revolting in Iranian strongholds. Cities attacking the Iranian consulate in Iran. So such news of a big figure who was controlling their lives, their future, their cities is hugely celebrated today in Iraq.
In this country, in the United States, there is a lot of talk and fear today about being a step closer to war with Iran. Does it feel that way where you are too?
Well, certainly that's what many people are reading it, and that's how also the Iranians are hinting to, because they said that they will respond and they will take revenge for this killing. The how and when is yet to be known. Iran is known to carefully craft their reactions, carefully craft their strategy. This is a big blow for them. This is a man who is the stronghold of the country, so they're going to respond and hit hard. And they said that they're going to be after American interest as well. And that could be beyond the region, and it could be not only be towards American interest, but also allies of the Americans. And certainly with a country here in the region that Iran has a lot of tension with, namely Israel.
Israel, right. Does the death of Soleimani destabilize Iran's power in the region, as the United States government would hope it would? Or in some way, does it make Iran even stronger?
Well, it's really hard to see at the moment. Iran has been suffering from a lot from sanctions, and this has been felt in its presence also in the region. You know, they are short in money. They are struggling a lot with their economy. Their ally Hezbollah here is also feeling the struggle of the economic crisis. It's hard to tell at the moment if their presence or control is going to be weakened, but certainly it's only adding to destabilizing this region.
That's the BBC's Lina Sinja. She is in Beirut. Lina, thanks for your reporting. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Makers of e-cigarette products have about a month to take fruit, candy, and mint-flavored vaping cartridges off the market. The Trump administration announced a temporary ban on the sale of those products yesterday. It's part of an effort to make vaping less appealing to kids. NPR's Allison Aubrey has been following developments on this story today, and she joins us now. Hi, Allison.
Hi there.
And tell me more about this ban, because there are some key products that it does not include, tobacco and menthol-flavored cartridges.
That's right. Well, the Trump administration officials who put this new policy together say they really want to target the products that teenagers are using. And they say kids are mainly using these flavored cartridges. That's because they're easy to use and up till now have been easy to get. Mm-hmm. Juul is the main brand that everyone knows, and there are others too. Now, what the new policy does exempt are flavored vape fluids that are used in these more, you know, do-it-yourself open tank systems, which the administration says are mostly used by adults.
Yeah, so, what is that? What is an open tank system?
Well, that's when you would go into a vape shop, and rather than just buying an off-the-shelf product that you snap in, you're sort of having your vape fluid mixed by this vape shop. It's sort of more custom.
I see. So help me understand this. The big e-cigarette maker Juul had already stopped selling flavored products. So is this going to even make much of a difference to the industry?
Well, that's right. They'd stop selling the products. But remember, there are other manufacturers out there. And the FDA has now left open, the administration, I should say, has now left open the door for companies to come back and submit an application that could bring these products back to the marketplace.
The number of kids who are vaping, I mean, it is pretty staggering. The federal government says more than 5 million middle and high schoolers have vaped recently, and people may not have noticed this, but the legal age to buy tobacco products just went up to 21 years old. What are anti-smoking groups saying about this latest move by the administration? If these changes are going to help keep vaping products away from kids?
Well, public health advocates do not think that this policy is enough. In fact, a lot of public health groups I spoke to yesterday are really upset. I mean, for months now, groups including the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Heart Association, American Lung Association, they've all been calling for the Trump administration to completely clear the market of flavored e-cigarettes, all flavors. They say it's really clear that the flavors are what attracted so many kids to vaping. Now, because the flavors sounded so fun and familiar, like cotton candy, teens somehow got the impression that vaping was harmless, and some teens didn't even realize that there was nicotine in the product. So the public health advocates are angry. I mean, these products could reappear on the market. I spoke to the American Lung Association's point person on this, and he says, look, you could drive a school bus through the loopholes in the new policy. It just doesn't go far enough to protect or stop kids from vaping.
The details of the administration's plan seems seem to have changed a lot over the last couple of weeks. And in fact, the president started by saying that the ban would be a lot stricter than it ended up being. What were some of the political calculations that were at play there?
Well, I mean, the administration started to hear from a lot of conservative groups, you know, politics makes for strange bedfellows. A lot of conservative groups came out and said, we vape, we vote, is what the administration started hearing. And a lot of groups lined up to say, there needs to be a more nuanced policy here. I think the president was hearing from all sides. And yesterday, what she heard from Alex Azar is this idea that they're trying to strike this balance, is what he said. You know, they want adults who are vaping as part of a strategy to quit smoking cigarettes to still have access to these flavors and the products that they want. The argument here is that vaping is less harmful than smoking cigarettes. Yet I should say the evidence is really mixed on this. A lot of smokers end up vaping and smoking together at the same time. So they could be getting even more nicotine.
That's NPR correspondent Allison Aubrey. Thanks very much for your reporting. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And there's hope in New Hampshire that this new ban will cut down on teen vaping in that state. More high school students there use e-cigarettes than in any other place in the country, according to the CDC. And officials are struggling to find ways to get them to stop. New Hampshire Public Radio's Sarah Gibson reports.
Lori Warnock isn't a smoker, but she spends a lot of time at vape shops.
So there's the Juul products there.
Warnock visits these shops to stay up to date in her job with the Northern New England Poison Center. She trains school officials, students, and their parents on the risks of e-cigarettes. She points to a small box featuring a photo of a sleek Juul vaping device.
And it's packaged just like an iPhone. This is the charger port that goes right into your USB port. And you could see where you could, you know, fit it in your sleeve or whatever. And that's the whole magic right there.
Users put flavored juices into the device, which, when charged, turns the liquid into a vapor to inhale. Warnock points to a wall of e-juices.
Swedish fish, dragon fruit, pink lemonade.
Teens tend to prefer the mint and fruit flavors.
This is gummy bear.
Oh, yeah, it's very sweet.
It smells just like gummy bears.
The e-juice has a small label that it contains nicotine. The concentration levels are high, and Warnock says that's particularly risky for teenage brains because the dopamine reward can be more intense.
The nicotine as an addictive chemical changes their brains in permanent ways that puts them at greater risk for other addictive behaviors as they get older.
A lot of this vaping is happening in schools. Students share vapes throughout the day, passing them in hallways or under bathroom stalls. It's tricky to catch someone in a bathroom unless you walk in and smell it.
A lot of the time you go in the stall and you're like, mint, like you know.
Marissa McKay is a senior at Londonderry High School. She says she doesn't vape, but she suspects many of her friends are addicted.
Some people are going through like a full pod a day, and they're like, no, I can stop anytime I want. I'm like, no, you can't.
A full pod a day. To show just how much that is, her classmate Tim Gore pulls out an infographic he made for the school newspaper.
Got the infographic. So this says a single Juul pod contains as much nicotine as a pack of regular cigarettes.
Students on the newspaper staff are hoping that information like this will make their peers think twice about vaping. And there's also public health ads. They say flood their social media. Juliana Hamill takes out her phone and starts playing a video showing graphic images of lung damage.
This is like one I see all the time.
Epidemic spreading. It can expose your lungs to acrolein, which can cause irreversible damage. It's not a parasite, not a virus. It's vaping.
The students here say this kind of scare tactic might work, but you got to get kids when they're young, before middle school.
It's frustrating. It seems like an uphill battle sometimes.
Mary D. Winkler teaches English and journalism here. She says school officials are still working out how to discipline teens caught vaping. Last year, a student who got suspended for vaping was barred from extracurriculars for 180 days. D. Winkler says the punishment was unproductive.
And, you know, it just kind of destroyed a kid. They did one stupid thing, and now they're out of the sport that may have been keeping them kind of on track. Okay, you're suspended. What are you going to do at home? You're going to sit around and vape.
With this in mind, Londonderry is now suspending students from their extracurriculars for just 20 days. Around New Hampshire, schools discipline strategies vary widely. Some are installing vape sensors in the bathroom, others issuing court citations or referring teens to drug and alcohol counselors. And it's getting more complicated because schools now are seeing more vapes with the marijuana ingredient THC. In a parking lot next to Londonderry High School, I find a cluster of cars full of teenagers vaping after school. How does it make you feel?
Vaping?
Yeah. They tell me it makes their head rush, their limbs tingle. It's this strange combination of feeling alert but also calm. That's the nicotine. Nick tells me he started as a freshman.
I saw one of my older friends hitting one, and I was curious, so I asked to hit it.
That's what it's called, hitting it?
Yeah.
Okay. We're not using Nick's last name because until recently, he wasn't old enough to legally vape. He and his friends say it's easy to get vape products, either at a store that doesn't card or by dealing over the instant messenger app Snapchat. Nick says he knows vaping isn't good for him. He's thinking about stopping, but not necessarily for health reasons.
It kind of looks childish at some point because of just all the young kids doing it.
Wait, so because people are so young who start, it's like, yeah, the kids?
I thought about that once I turned 18. I looked at it and I'm like, man, there's a lot of young kids doing this.
Nick and his friends say they're not ready to stop quite yet, but they plan to eventually. For Here and Now, I'm Sarah Gibson.
A recent study published in the journal Epidemiology reports that fewer Black Americans have died from prescription opioids compared to their white counterparts. And further analysis estimates roughly 14,000 Black American lives were spared. And the reasons are clear. They weren't prescribed the strong painkillers as often as white patients. For a deeper look at the implications of these findings, we're joined by Dr. Andrew Kolotny. He's the director of opioid policy research at Brandeis University. And Dr. Kolotny, explain how racial bias factors into the prescribing of opioids.
Something we know from studies is that if a patient is Black, the doctor is less likely to prescribe narcotics. It might be that if the patient is Black, the doctor might be more worried about the patient becoming addicted. Or maybe if the patient is Black, they're more worried about the patient selling their medication, or maybe if the patient is Black, they're just less sensitive to the patient's pain. What appears to be happening is that racial stereotyping has been having a protective effect on Black patients. So the Black patient is less likely to become addicted to opioids because they're less likely to be prescribed. And they're also less likely to have opioids in the medicine chest where family members could become opioid addicted. Obviously, doctors should be prescribing cautiously to all of our patients.
At the same time, Dr. Kolotny, it's horrifying. Anyone who has had a family member who has gone through a procedure or is dealing with intense pain and perhaps has not had their doctor prescribe medicines for whatever reason knows that while it may have prevented them from perhaps later down the road becoming addicted, in the moment, it really is prohibiting them from actually getting some sort of relief and living perhaps sometimes in chronic pain.
Well, opioids are actually lousy drugs for the vast majority of patients with chronic pain. And it is certainly possible that African Americans are not getting adequate pain treatment. But we don't know that. What we know is that they're less likely to be prescribed opioids. And we shouldn't really equate an aggressive opioid prescription or getting opioids with treatment of pain. Opioids are not the only treatments for pain.
Do you have any indication that then some of those alternatives are given to Black Americans when they see doctors and are not given opioids?
No, I just don't think we know either way. I think it is possible that pain is more likely to be untreated even with non-opioid modalities, but I'm not aware of research in that area. One of the reasons we know that opioids are prescribed less frequently to Black patients is because pharmaceutical companies have sponsored some of these studies with an interest in getting doctors to prescribe opioids as frequently to their Black patients as they do to their white patients.
Yeah, because it's a numbers game. It's a money game.
That's correct.
I want to go back to something you said about some of the possible reasons, one being that Black people have a higher pain threshold than white people because perhaps they were biologically different.
I remember reading several years ago research from the University of Virginia that found that white medical students and residents, more than half, believed that African Americans had thicker skin. And other studies have found that white physicians implicitly prefer white patients because they think they're more intelligent or will heed their advice. How persistent is this racial bias in medical school and in medical care overall?
Yeah, I don't know whether or not racist notions about differences in physiology or pain come from. I think it may simply be that doctors, like everybody else in society, are not immune to racism.
Yeah. What was the most remarkable thing to you about this study?
Well, yeah, I think it's interesting the way that it was reported, and that as if, you know, this is good news for Black Americans, that 14,000 lives were saved. The other way of thinking about this, though, is that rather than good news for Black Americans, this was very bad news for white Americans. And one way of thinking about racist notions about treatment of pain is that if a doctor has an idea in their mind of what an addict looks like, they think an addict is someone who's likely to be non-white and maybe from a low-income community, and they have a white middle-class patient that they're treating, there's the possibility that that incorrect view of addiction and that racial stereotyping is actually harming the white patient, because rather than recognizing that addiction is a disease that can happen to just about anybody who's repeatedly exposed to a highly addictive drug, they may just assume that addiction is something that happens to those people, and my white mm-hmm. middle-class patient is somehow immune. And so if doctors continue to believe that, you know, addiction is an issue for a subset of our population who are interested in abusing drugs and behaving badly, rather than understanding that addiction can be caused by exposure, I'm concerned that they'll continue to overprescribe.
That's Dr. Andrew Kolotny, Director of Opioid Research at Brandeis University. Thank you so much, Doctor.
Thanks for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. What's next between the U.S., Iran, and Iraq after an American airstrike killed a powerful military commander? Is the U.S. a step closer to the brink of war? Also, we head to Iowa, where former Vice President Joe Biden is kicking his campaign into high gear ahead of next month's caucus. That's next time on Here and Now.